welcome with us today two groups of high school students. We have students from the Fall River High School. Would they please stand? It's good having you with us. Please be seated. And we have students from Lincoln High School. Would they stand? Thank you for coming. It's good having you all. Please be seated. The students are here with the Court with Class program. It's a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin in this court. We invite high school students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If they agree to do that, we send them the briefs in the case they are about to hear, and they may engage in activities concerning that case. When they come, they're invited to participate after the second case this morning in a discussion with a justice. That discussion will involve the procedures of the court in deciding cases. It does not involve the substantive issues in the case. And everyone is welcome to join the students at that time. So let me now introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. It is Justice Butler who is the justice with whom you'll meet today at noon about the case. Seated next to Justice Butler is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. Having given you the lineup today, we will now turn to our first case, 04AP803CR, State v. John W. Campbell. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Campbell is Assistant State Public Defender Charles Vetzner. Mr. Vetzner.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, I am Charles Vetzner, appearing on behalf of John W. Campbell, the appellant in this case. This case is before the court on a certification from the Court of Appeals. The primary certified issue concerns the right of a party to collaterally attack a prior order of a court on the ground that the prior order was entered as the result of fraud. The state is arguing that Mr. Campbell should not be permitted to defeat his criminal liability in this particular circumstance by collaterally attacking a Walworth County custody order. The state has given a number of reasons as to why that collateral attack should not have been permitted, as the trial judge had ruled. Primarily, the state argues that collateral attack should be limited to fraud that affects a court's jurisdiction.
Mr. Vetzner, this has troubled me, this question I'm going to ask, because we're talking about the fraud that possibly happened in the state of Missouri, the adoption of this child. And it's bothered me in this way that your client, neither you nor your client particularly, went back to challenge the fraud that took place in Missouri. So is this an assumption that there's fraud that took place in Missouri? I've had a chance to, one of the justices looked at one of the, the statute in Missouri. It's bothered me that no one went back. That's where you should be attacking whether or not this was a valid adoption. How do we know? Do we know right now whether or not that's a valid adoption in Missouri?
No, we don't know whether it's a valid adoption.
So the troubling question is that if we adopt your argument that you should use and be able to use a fraud exception, what stops anybody from saying, well, a fraud took place in this capacity when there hasn't been any proven fraud? In other words, we don't know whether there is or is not fraud in this case.
Well, let me answer that, but let me first back up to your point that this case involves a claim of fraud in Missouri. It is our position that the fraud we're focusing on is not what arguably was fraud in Missouri, but is fraud that took place in Wisconsin, in Walworth County. Our claim is that the fraud that we should be focusing on is when the divorce petition was filed and Denise claimed to be the natural or adoptive mother of Cody. We're claiming that that's what we should be focusing on. Now, it does happen, and it admittedly complicates the particular facts in this case, that the basis for the defense to claim fraud on the divorce petition relates to what essentially was fraud in another state. But the point that I've been trying to make in litigating this case is that Campbell's right to litigate the validity of the custody order in no way depends on whether or not there was some fraudulent act that took place in another jurisdiction. One of the examples that I tried to make, maybe not an example, but I said that this case should be analyzed no differently on the facts that were alleged by Campbell than if there had never been an attempt to adopt Cody. And Denise, who is the mother who filed for the adoption, had simply lived there was a marriage and she was simply a step-parent, and then at the time there was a divorce that was undertaken, she just alleged that she was the adoptive mother. I guess another example that I didn't have in the brief, but maybe would bring in that multi-state aspect to this, is that the adoption takes place after the adoption is over. The next day, there's a letter sent to Campbell and to Denise saying, your check bounced for some fees that are required for the adoption. We want you to know that this adoption is invalid until you pay that fee, and then they never do it. Well, in that circumstance, Denise would be on notice that there is not a valid adoption, but I wouldn't say in that circumstance there was fraud in Missouri. It would be a circumstance in which she was simply aware that she was not lawfully the adoptive mother of Cody, and it would be improper for her at the time she filed for divorce to allege that she was the adoptive mother.
But, Counselor, I think what Justice Wilcox is getting at is that your argument of fraud on the Wisconsin court is dependent upon the adoption not being valid in Missouri. But we don't know that it isn't valid in Missouri. So you kind of have the cart before the horse, don't you?
Well, Justice Wilcox's particular question was, couldn't anybody allege this? I suppose that's the same for any affirmative defense that's going to be presented, whether it's entrapment in a drug case or whether it's self-defense in a homicide case. You can allege it, but even though ultimately it is our position that the prosecution would have the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, that where it's an affirmative defense of this nature, the defense has a burden of production. So Campbell can't just say fraud on the court, the case disappears. It was Campbell's position that this was a factual matter in which he had a right to present evidence to support his claim at the trial.
Mr. Vetchner, how do you get to the point of alleging that this is an affirmative defense. As I understand it, it's not one of the defenses listed in the statute, and I'm wondering how you're making that determination and that argument that this is indeed an affirmative defense.
Well, I've characterized it as a common law affirmative defense. I guess somewhat similar to State versus Hobson, a case that was cited in the brief, which involved, and it's perhaps an apt comparison. In State versus Hobson, this court dealt with a common law affirmative defense of the right to resist, to physically resist an unlawful arrest. And the reason why I say it's perhaps particularly appropriate to compare it to Hobson is that the state in the Hobson case had argued that that common law defense was outdated, was archaic, and should be abrogated. And this court agreed with that, but was very careful to say that even though the court was eliminating the affirmative defense, it was doing so in a prospective fashion, that it would violate ex post facto provisions to apply it to Hobson herself. In this case, what I think the state's key point is that the collateral attack for an order procured by fraud is archaic and outdated. I don't think the state is saying it should be abrogated altogether, but it should be limited to fraud that affects a court's jurisdiction.
Mr. Vestner, before you go there, I want to follow up Justice Crook's question for just a moment. You have raised this as an affirmative defense. I'm looking at the jury instructions, 2166 for interference with custody of a child, that says the second element requires that the name of the custodian, in this case Denise, had legal custody of the child under a court order or judgment in an action for divorce. Why did you not challenge this? This seems to be different than Smith, where we weren't dealing with an element of the offense. Here we're looking at the element of legal custody, and I'm curious as to why you abandoned that argument.
Well, I...
seems to have been made by your client, that's what
I'm saying. Well, I didn't abandon it. To be candid, from the outset, when I initiated the litigation in this case, it just struck me that this was a circumstance that really fit within the Bozick and Schrammick versus Boren line of cases about the right to collaterally attack an order where it was based on fraud. The state in its brief went through a very long section of its brief as to why the fraud claim wouldn't go to an element. I could have made that argument. I guess in retrospect, I'm glad I didn't in light of the Smith case. But I do think that even assuming that the claim that the argument that an order was the result of fraud doesn't go to an element doesn't mean that the circumstance here doesn't make it appropriate as an affirmative defense. I guess the one other thing I wanted to say about characterizing this as an affirmative defense is that it's not entirely clear, I would concede, as to whether it should be treated that way. It could be treated arguably as some type of legal claim that needs to be addressed before the trial. In a lot of the cases that dealt with this fraud, let me back up. The fraud issue is a matter that can be raised both in civil and in criminal cases. A lot of the cases that dealt with this dealt with it in the context of civil litigation where characterizing it as a collateral attack really was literally correct, because it supported an the fraud claim was raised as an independent legal action for some type of equitable relief. In that circumstance, the matter was not decided by a jury. The matter was simply heard by the judge and then decided. And in fact, one of the cases that fit into that category that I think deserves particular mention, and again, maybe it, just like whether or not I should have challenged this in an, as an element or not, is a reflection on some tardy research on my part. But I did want to emphasize a case particularly that was cited in the reply brief, Estate of Boots, 73 was second. It seems to me that that case expressly repudiates the state's primary argument that you can only raise fraud collaterally if it affects the court's jurisdiction. In that particular case, which was a civil case, but goes back to this line of cases of Zunzek versus American Automobile Insurance Company, the party defending the prior order said you can't collaterally attack this because everybody concedes that the court that entered the initial order, which in that particular circumstance was a probate order, you can't attack it because everybody concedes that the court had jurisdiction to enter that probate order. And this court, in dealing with the collateral challenge, said it doesn't matter whether we view this as collateral or direct because there is no limitation on collateral attack of an order resulting from fraud based on jurisdiction. If the order was procured by fraud, that's enough, regardless of whether or not it relates to the court's jurisdiction. So I think that that case really completely undermines the state's position that there is any prior line of cases that limits this fraud exception to circumstances that affect the court's jurisdiction.
Counsel, one of the arguments advanced by the state was that let's get modern. You know, let's
right.
Get, and I don't know the year of 73, Wisconsin's second, the Estate of Boots case, but they posit that the modern approach is that it should, the attack should be limited to jurisdictional fraud. So let me say, and I have not read Estate of Boots. You said it was cited in your reply brief, but I'm sorry I didn't read that. I read the Buzak and the Zrimsek case and the other ones that were really more in play here. But I say, well, okay, even if Boots says what you say it does, and I assume that it certainly does, we're not bound by that. And let's get thoroughly modern. there's some arguments that the state makes, not only that we should be modern for the sake of being modern, but it's good public policy, the state says, to limit it to jurisdictional fraud. Respond, if you will.
Sure. I hear your question. I think there's several responses. First of all, when the state says we ought to limit this to jurisdictional fraud, they're basing that on the concept of jurisdictional fraud as used in a legal encyclopedia, Corpus Juris Secundum. What I tried to point out is that encyclopedic definition of jurisdiction is not very consistent with this court's prior cases that define jurisdiction. That when the encyclopedia says fraud should be limited to jurisdictional fraud, they're including in their definition of jurisdiction what in this court, in this state, we would call a court's competency to act as well as jurisdiction. So I don't think that this court is out of date. I just think that if the court wants to get modern, perhaps the court wants to look at its use of the term jurisdiction as opposed to the court's competency to act And I don't think this Court wants to go there. I know that dealing with that in terms of the time limit cases.
What's modern, competence or jurisdiction?
What's modern? I don't think one is modern and one is outdated. I just think that the Court has developed its own particular parlance in terms of jurisdiction and competence, completely apart from this question about fraud. I also wanted to come back to the point I had made about Hobson in responding to Justice Bradley's question. If Justice Bradley and the Court disagree, this Court is out of date, let's get modern, we're going to change the rule of Zimzik in all these cases, okay. But that brings us back to the Hobson case that you can't do it retroactively, you can only do it prospectively. You can't take away a defense that existed at the time of trial as part of this Court's supposed push toward getting modern.
Mr. Bessner, if
it's okay, go ahead.
If you're only challenging the Walworth County
order, I'm sorry, if I'm only challenging
the Walworth County orders and you're not really challenging the Missouri order, assuming we were to say that there was an affirmative offense, you still have to meet a burden of production to get that defense before the Court. If there's no evidence that the Missouri adoption was invalid, how does the defendant meet the burden of production to even put the issue before the jury?
Well, when you say there's no evidence, there was no evidence presented at trial. And, of course, the reason there was no evidence presented at trial is that there was a motion filed in advance of trial by the prosecutor to bar that evidence. The judge granted that motion, but the defendant had submitted both an affidavit and had made an oral offer of proof, the transcript of the oral offer of proof and a copy of the affidavit are part of the appendix to my brief.
But I guess my question goes to the fact that even here today at oral argument, you've indicated that you don't know whether or not the adoption is invalid in Missouri. And if we don't know that the adoption is invalid in Missouri, just saying that she didn't live there, if you go back and you look at the Missouri statutes, she lived there at the time of the filing of the adoption. She didn't live there, at least allegedly, when the adoption is granted. How do we know what the Missouri law is in terms of whether or not a person can leave the state once filing? We don't even know if there's a violation. And isn't there an initial burden that the defendant has to show that there is a problem with Missouri law before you even get to the affirmative defense?
Well, if you treat it as a factual matter, part of the offer of proof by Campbell, and I can't remember now if it was both in the affidavit and in the oral offer of proof or just one of those, but there was an affirmative statement that it was necessary for the adoptive parties to be living in the state at the time the adoption was final and to try and the certification from the Court of Appeals made mention of the fact that in order to circumvent this, that the parties gave their attorney's address as their residential address. So I think that for purposes of where we are right now, where the evidence was barred, that there isn't a deficiency, that there was an offer of proof, and there really isn't any claim on the part of the state that there's any deficiency in that regard. The state's position is simply that the trial court was correct in its initial ruling because the deficiency in the offer of proof was that it didn't affect the jurisdiction of the court. And we're saying that's not the correct test. Nobody is claiming that there was any deficiency as a factual matter or a deficiency in regard to presenting claims of law regarding the law in Missouri or in Wisconsin.
Mr. Vetzner, if you were going to write the decision of this court in favor of your client, obviously, I want you to outline that decision because I'm not quite sure I understand your position in light of these questions in from your brief. So tell me how you would expect the court to write this. So
well, since my amber light is on, I'm going to do it in one paragraph rather than the typical maybe 40 paragraphs.
That's why I'm asking you, because your amber light is on. Go ahead.
It would be simply to reaffirm prior case law from this court emanating from Zunzik versus American Automobile Insurance Company that a party has a right to collaterally attack a prior order or judgment of another court where that other order was procured by fraud.
Okay, and here we're talking about the Wisconsin judgment.
Correct.
Specifically,
we're talking about the custody order that Campbell violated.
All right.
Mr. Beston,
where does that get you?
I'm sorry.
Pardon me?
Where does that get you?
That gets me to overturning the decision of the trial court, and my position would warrant a new trial at which the defendant would be able to put in his evidence, and then the state would need to prove beyond a reasonable doubt what I would view as one of four elements of fraud. And the four elements would be, first of all, that false information was provided to the court, meaning the Walworth County Court. The person providing the false information knew it was false. The person providing the false information intended to mislead the court. And the court, meaning the divorce court, or the custody court, relied on the false information in making its ruling and would or should have decided the matter differently if truthful information had been provided.
The state proves this or your client? Who proves fraud?
The defendant would have an initial burden of production of all four of those points. Then the state would need to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that at least one of those four facts did not exist.
No doubt that element, that fraud didn't exist. Okay. All right. Then where do you go? So suppose there's four here. So, and it's raised a problem. Is it an element of the crime that there be custody? Is that your argument?
Well,
is it an element or is it an affirmative defense? I mean, you still have a problem. Maybe it's a lousy, invalid judgment in the divorce case. Then what do you have to do?
Well, if the custody order was the result of fraud, then it's not a basis for Campbell to be convicted of violating that order.
Because it's an element of the crime?
Well, it's an affirmative defense, which then merges, once the burden of production is met, it merges as comparable to being an element, yes.
Chief, if I could follow
Mr.
up.
Mr. Spotler.
You've challenged the validity of the Walworth County orders based upon Denise's knowledge that she shouldn't really be the adoptive parent because of the fraud and alleged fraud in Missouri. Yet she went to the Walworth County Court with an adoption decree from Missouri. So technically, for purposes of Wisconsin, she was the adoptive parent, although arguably she shouldn't have been taking your client's position because of what she did in Missouri. So I guess I'm having problems seeing how it's a fraud on the Wisconsin court without getting back at the fraud, alleged fraud in Missouri, because regardless of everything else, she still got that document saying, I'm the adoptive parent. So unless you really go back to challenge Missouri, how do you present a fraud in Wisconsin?
I think that goes to the knowledge portion. If she had If she had gone to Kinko's and made her own little order, we wouldn't say that that's going to do anything. The fact that there's a facial order, if she knows that that order is no good, then there's still fraud. The fact that she presented it as proof doesn't resolve it. We're not...
Vexner is a lot different saying as a factual matter she doctored a document than saying that you have to trust her legal knowledge of whether that Missouri judgment was any good. I think that's the point of Justice Butler's questioning to you.
Could I ask a question?
Do you understand what I'm
I understand what you're saying.
A witness comes in and says, oh, this judgment from the United States Supreme Court is no good. It's invalid. I'm going to say, hey, I don't care if you have a law degree. And I don't care how long you've practiced law. I don't have to take your word for whether that judgment's any good. You have to test it. If you can allow this collateral attack, you have to go back and prove it. Because Missouri law is a matter of, I think most of the time, a fact that the court will find, and you have expert witnesses that prove it.
Well, but this is a circumstance where it was her belief that it was no good. It's not a matter of her doing some legal research after the circumstance.
Who cares about her belief whether the adoption's any good? If the adoption is good, it's good. Whether she thinks it's good or not is irrelevant. If it's bad, even if she thinks it's good, it's not relevant. Anyway, I pose that to you. Justice Prosser has a...
As I understand the facts, Cody, the child, was adopted, and I think the argument is made, was adopted fraudulently. Where does Cody stand in all this if you prevail? Does he get unadopted?
Probably not, because the fact that we're collaterally attacking the validity of the order for purposes of Campbell criminal liability does not necessarily resolve whether, as of right now, today, the adoption is directly applicable in terms of his status as the parent.
If he doesn't get unadopted, whose custody is he in?
Well, there's an additional complication in that regard, since part of the claim of fraud that Campbell had raised in his affidavit, although it kind of got... kind of fell by the wayside but was never resolved, is that the Campbell claimed that the adoption was invalid for a whole second reason, and that is that the natural mother, Vicky, who was also involved in this proceeding, had never voluntarily terminated her parental rights. So there was a whole second potential issue here that is a reason to question the validity of the adoption anyway. So in that regard, I guess maybe the easy answer is if the adoption is invalid, then Cody is the son of Vicky rather than Denise, but in any event, he's not going to be an orphan.
Was Vicky before the court?
Vicky actually was a witness at this trial.
But, I mean, the natural mother, did she ever challenge the fact that she had lost parental rights in Cody?
No, she did not.
Anyway, it would not be handled in the criminal matter. That's your real answer, that this is what...
Correct.
Civilly, and whether or not you could use what the criminal court did in a civil action in dealing with the adoption. That's another problem.
For the next argument, right. Thank you very much.
Which won't be yours because it'll be a civil issue. Right. Okay, Mr. Vetzner. Thank you. Arguing on behalf of the state is Assistant Attorney General James M. Freimuth. Mr. Freimuth.
Excuse me. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General James Freimuth, representing the state of Wisconsin as respondent in this criminal case. Before outlining how the state would ask this court to rule in this case, I would just like to address the very first question from Justice Wilcox, and that is concerning what do we know about the adoption in Missouri. And hidden in the state's brief at page 30 is a footnote that refers to Missouri law. It cites a 2004 case, but in back-checking on the statute was in place back in 1998 when this was all happening. That statute in Missouri says, and I'm quoting here, the statute is 453.160.2, and it reads, any consent required for an adoption, and in this case Mr. Campbell gave consent to the adoption of Cody, may only be revoked within 1 year of the date of such consent for fraud or duress. So Cody was adopted in March 1997 by Denise James. Campbell consented to that adoption. In September and December of 1997 is when the custody orders were being developed in Wisconsin, or that's when the Walworth County Court issued those orders in the divorce action. On February 1st, 1998, is when Mr. Campbell absconded with Cody and Randy to Mexico. He had until March 1998, according to Missouri law, to withdraw his consent to that adoption. So by the time of trial, Mr. Campbell was not arrested until 2001. So by the time of trial at the end of 2001, if I understand, if I read Missouri law correctly, the adoption of Cody was not, certainly not invalid, and any challenge of fraud could no longer be made by Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Feinruth, maybe I misread the record, and correct me if I'm wrong on this.
Sure.
My understanding was that not that Mr. Campbell consented to the adoption, but was in fact a petitioner on the adoption. Am I misreading that?
I thought he consented.
I thought it was a joint petition by Mr. Campbell and by Ms. Campbell.
I don't know for sure. My impression was that he consented. There is a question, in fact, that in that he was purporting to be the biological father of Cody, and then that became unclear when at sentencing he said he probably wasn't the biological father. But that was my impression. I'd have to look, and I just don't know offhand.
What import, if any, I mean, that was, you speak of hidden in a footnote. That was another hidden in a footnote in your brief, that at sentencing he said that he probably was not the biological father. When I read that, I threw up my hands. So what are we doing?
Yeah, this,
what import does that have, if any, here?
Well, that part of it, his complicity, if you will, in the residency problem in Missouri. In other words, he and Denise James moved to Wisconsin while the adoption was being processed in Missouri. So he certainly was aware of what was going on. And then in the Walworth County matter, and throughout this process, even in Missouri, if he knew he wasn't really the biological father, it may not have been. This goes into this notion of if fraud is this, if there's this some kind of defense, whether it's an affirmative defense, which in a moment I'll suggest why it isn't, or if it goes to negate somehow the legal custody element, which I think is really where this argument probably fits best as far as a legal framework, that Campbell's complicity in all this would be part of sort of this unclean hands notion. In other words, the state's position on this, and I'll be more precise in a moment, is that the only fraud that is relevant, or only evidence of fraud, is fraud that would go to the jurisdiction of the family court issuing the custody orders. When the defendant's claim of fraud implicates that jurisdiction, you've got a threshold question for the trial court to resolve. In resolving that threshold question, the defendant's complicity or not in that the fraud that he's claiming that his ex-wife perpetrated on the family court would be taken into account in that determination being made by the court as to whether this is evidence that either means that there is no valid order whatsoever, in other words, it was a nullity, and so therefore no criminal prosecution can proceed, or whether it's the kind of thing that needs to go to the jury to address that element, that custody element. But that would be only if there's a factual, some kind of a factual dispute relevant to that. For example, well, I won't say for example, but the jurisdictional fraud that I'm, and I think this is a very narrow, limited category of fraud, and maybe before getting myself into more trouble here trying to articulate this, if I may just outline how I would like the court to rule. To begin, regardless of how it rules on count two, count one is the interference with Randy's custody. That's not at issue. Count two is the interference with Cody's custody. And count three is bail jumping. Counts two and three are the ones at issue. Regardless of how this court rules on count two, Cody's custody, it should affirm the conviction of bail jumping. Because juries unanimously found Campbell guilty of count one, that's interference with Randy's custody, they necessarily would have found him guilty of bail jumping for committing that crime, count one, regardless of whether the fraud evidence had been introduced and they heard that and had some doubt about count two. With respect to count two, Cody's custody, this court should hold that the proffered fraud evidence was properly excluded as irrelevant. First, the proffered fraud evidence does not serve to negate the legal custody element of count two because it does not implicate the family court's jurisdiction to issue the custody orders.
Mr. Feinmuth, if I can ask you about that, and I know Mr. Betzner's argument is a bit different from his client's argument at the trial court level. His client was not represented, although he had standby counsel, and that's a separate issue. But with respect to his client's position, it appeared that the client said all along, look, the Missouri adoption was invalid. The Missouri adoption was invalid. The Missouri adoption was invalid. If that was his position, and it was based on his the fact that they did not, in fact, live in Missouri, wouldn't that be a jurisdictional claim for the Missouri court? And if it is a jurisdictional claim, didn't Mr. Campbell have a right to present that to the trial court as he attempted to do?
The question of whether or not this residency problem in Missouri would go to the Missouri court's jurisdiction for the adoption of Cody is a question that is not answered on the record because that was not developed. The focus, and I think this is complicated because of the two-step process. The Walworth County Court certainly had, the court commissioner had, subject matter jurisdiction and competency and personal jurisdiction. Mr. Campbell appeared for the custody determinations, so there's personal jurisdiction. The subject matter jurisdiction is by statute. Those requirements were met. And at the documents that reflect the adoption decree from Missouri was certainly what the Walworth County Court could rely on. The second level, which would go back to that, the challenging of the fraud in Missouri, would be sort of a second collateral attack, I guess. It would be a collateral attack on the Walworth County order and then a collateral attack on the Missouri order. I looked hard to see if I could find anything that would tell me whether moving after properly initiating a adoption petition with residency and then moving out of state, whether that somehow would be critical to any jurisdiction for that adoption. And I don't find any declaration, didn't find anything that would answer that question for me. So whether the Walworth County Criminal Court, when Campbell made that argument, should have gone beyond the Walworth County Family Court to look at that, at the Missouri matter. In the absence of any suggestion that this was a jurisdictional problem, I guess the answer is Mr. Campbell hasn't made his threshold requirement of doing that. And I don't find a legal answer here. I didn't find a legal answer that would answer that question. NICRUD is the case that talks about competency. Subject matter jurisdiction is plenary. So when we're talking about a court having jurisdiction when there's a challenge to fraud, I would guess that with respect to competency, what Mikrut says, we talk about statutory matters or requirements for jurisdiction that are central to the scheme.
Of course, we don't know what Missouri's jurisdiction is.
And that's exactly what I'm saying.
Counsel, assume, and I was going to say playing, but that's not the right word. But I was looking also for playing around with trying to find the answer with regard to jurisdiction. That is, they weren't living in Missouri at the time. And I came across this Missouri statute in adoptions, and it says, if a petition for adoption has been filed pursuant to the general requisites for filing a petition, the court may authorize the filing for finalization in another state if the adoptive parents are domiciled in that state. Now, I realize that it's a little hard. You don't have this before you. But what import, if any, should we give to that? If a petition for adoption has been filed pursuant to 453.010, and the child is now with the purported adoptive parents, the court may authorize the filing for finalization in another state if the adoptive parents are domiciled in that state.
I think that supports the state's position in that it's not critical to the jurisdiction of the Missouri court issuing the adoption decree.
Go ahead.
I'm just going to say that I wondered whether, for example, if instead of using a Missouri lawyer's address as Denise James purportedly did, if she had just went to the adoption court and said, look, we're moving to Wisconsin, this is initiated in, and that seems to answer that question. So it would seem to me that that also is an answer here to that there was no meaningful, if you will, no jurisdictional fraud, no substantial fraud in the Missouri adoption as well as in the family court case in Wisconsin.
Why do we care in this case now before this court whether that Missouri adoption is valid or not? Seems the issue to me is, should we be looking at whether it's valid? I mean, can the defendant or state present evidence? I don't think this court or the parties here should say this is valid in Missouri, it's not valid. The issue is, can a defendant, as I see it, challenge a custody order, a Wisconsin custody order, on the basis that custody order is invalid, is void in the Wisconsin courts because there was a fraud on the Wisconsin court, the fraud being that the parties said there was an adoption and that the parties in procuring that adoption committed a fraud on the court, the Missouri court, granting the adoption. So, as I heard, I want to know what the law is, as you see it, whether it is or should be, as to when you can collaterally challenge. I mean, we have a double situation here, but when can you collaterally challenge another court's order on the basis of fraud? What's the rule of law you think should be here?
Right, and this was just what I was in the process of articulating here, and that is, and just a shorthand, is that only where it's jurisdictional fraud goes to jurisdictional fraud. In other words, only where the allegation of fraud, the proffered evidence, would render, if shown by the defendant, that child custody order a nullity so that it had no meaning whatsoever. In other words, the difference between the prior order being void and voidable, and that's the distinction that I'm trying to draw here through the history of the case law and the CJS materials on this. There's that one point where, I'm sorry.
Page 28 of your brief, footnote 2, says, collateral attack may be allowed as a matter of equity for alleged fraud that shocks the conscience or results in an unconscionable judgment. Does that mean that the fraud is not to be that there has to be fraud to make it a nullity, but the fraud in addition to that has to shock the conscience of the court? Is that the second prong?
Well, this seems to be a second line of cases that rather than using labels like extrinsic and interest, jurisdictional
matters. And you didn't use it. Yeah, okay, go ahead.
I think it also, when I was suggesting that even under that line of cases, if fraud evidence isn't limited only to jurisdictional fraud that goes to the jurisdiction of the court issuing the orders, whether the orders were void or not. But if it's this other line of fraud that says collateral attack may be allowed as a matter of equity, and these are civil cases, by the way, for alleged fraud that shocks the conscience of the court or results in an unconscionable judgment, even under that standard in this case, I was suggesting that wouldn't be met here in light of the complicity of Mr. Campbell in this and in light of the inadequate showing that he made that there was, in fact, the type of fraud that calls into question those custody orders.
Counsel, I want to return to your outline. I have number one, that the proffered evidence does not serve to negate an element unless the alleged fraud affects the court's jurisdiction to issue the order. That may not be verbatim, but close.
That's right.
Number two.
Okay, just a sub-point under number one, and that is that
1A.
That State, I think State versus Buzek, which is sort of the focus on which the defense argument, or the foundation on which the defense argument rises from, and the cases that preceded that, I think State versus Buzek is properly understood or limited to that kind of fraud. And we're only talking really here about it, and I'll get to my line real quick, but we're only talking here about a very narrow category of cases where there's a prior court order and that a violation of that order is a criminal offense. We're talking about child support, child custody, harassment injunction. Pretty much that's just about the entirety of the category, I think. The second point is when proffered fraud evidence implicates the family court's jurisdiction to issue a child custody order, it is a predicate question of law for the criminal court to determine, at least in the absence of historical fact relevant to that. This is in accordance with what this court recently said in Smith with respect to child support orders, that it's jurisdiction, we're talking about jurisdictional fraud, jurisdiction, this is a question for the court beforehand. It can, in effect, resolve the case before and end the case if, in fact, there was no valid court order that could have been violated. Third point on this topic is, in the present case, there is no dispute of fact that the family court had jurisdiction to issue the custody orders. And fourth is to address the legal framework of affirmative defense that the defense has put the fraud claim in. This court should hold that fraud in procuring a child custody order does not constitute an affirmative defense to interference with that order. There is no good policy justification for self-help interference with the child custodian's legal rights on a belief that the custodian obtained the custody order by fraud. Rather, such a belief is properly resolved in the family court. That's my outline of the fraud issue. Before leaving that, the other part of my initial outline here was to talk about standby counsel. We haven't discussed that. I would very quickly just outline what this is.
Before you move on to standby counsel, real quickly, I know you've argued the complicity of Mr. Campbell here, and I know in your brief you argued the clean hands doctrine, I think. I'm not sure clean hands applies here. But I am aware that Wisconsin has taken the approach that a party cannot appeal from a decision or a judgment or an order unless the party is aggrieved by the order. This is in a collateral attack, and at least that Mr. Vetsner is advancing in this case, as opposed to an appeal. And I don't know the answer to this, that's why I'm asking. Does that general rule apply to collateral attacks as well? If you know. You may not know, so.
I'm not quite sure I understand, but I don't.
Well, in this case, just to make it clear, the petition in the matter of adoption of Cody James Campbell was by John Campbell and Denise Campbell petitioners. Both parties petitioned for the adoption. And given the fact that both parties alleged that they lived in Lee's Summit, Jackson County, Missouri, and assuming that there would be some sort of jurisdictional violation by them moving out of the jurisdiction, which we don't know that that's the case, but assuming that for purposes of raising the challenge, the fact that James Campbell asked for Denise to become an adoptive parent would under Wisconsin law, preclude him from going back and challenging that on direct appeal. Does that rule also apply to collateral attacks?
And I'm afraid I don't know the answer after all that. I'm sorry.
What's the significance in this case that Campbell raised the fraud allegation in the divorce action, but then never continued that because he absconded? So he left it hanging there. Sort of like Smith, where in the main case.
Sure. I mean, I think initially, the prosecutor argued issue preclusion here on the notion that he had raised this and then basically defaulted on it by his absconding. I wasn't comfortable because there hadn't been an actual determination of that to use issue preclusion, and that's why I didn't pursue that argument. The fact that he absconded and could have challenged it, I guess, would be part of this unclean hands notion that the state is also advocating in this determination of whether there should be whether there was jurisdictional fraud that should excuse or render the court order a nullity, that's all part of that initial determination. On the issue fees of standby counsel, this was not certified by the Court of Appeals, but it is one of the issues raised by the defendant. The state's position on this is that would ask this court to hold as follows. In accordance with Section 973.09 sub 1G, excuse me, that's the probation statute that talks about holding it or putting as a condition of probation requiring a defendant to pay, quote, the cost of legal representation. In accordance with that provision, as well as the costs statute, which is 973.06 sub 1 sub E, which also allows a court to tax a defendant for the costs of, quote, attorney fees. In other words, I'm suggesting there should be no difference between attorney fees and cost of legal representation under these two statutes. It shouldn't matter whether you're put on probation or.
How would attorney's fees apply in this case if we're talking about standby counsel?
The argument is that standby counsel where it is, and this is the proposition that the state would ask this court to hold, that under these two statutes, a trial court has authority to order a convicted defendant to pay the reasonable fees of using standby counsel at trial, but only if the defendant requests or accepts standby counsel with the express understanding that the defendant will reimburse the county for such fees subject to the defendant's ability to pay.
What about all the language in McCaskill versus Wiggins that suggests that standby counsel really services the court, does not service the defendant, cannot take over the representation of the defense, has to submit to the wishes of the client, and really sets this as a separate animal, distinct from an attorney. I find it somewhat strange that you have a defendant who does not have counsel, clearly does not have counsel to represent him at the trial level, yet is being required to pay for the cost of a standby counsel, which by definition under McCaskill is designed to assist the court.
I guess my first response to that is that standby counsel isn't exclusively designed to assist the court. The role of standby counsel also is to to serve the needs of the pro se defendant. And I think standby counsel's job, because of that and because the defendant is the one calling the shots, often can be more onerous than an appointed or a retained counsel's role. Go ahead.
You limited standby fees if the court may do it under the statute, if the defendant agrees to standby counsel and agrees to pay fees if can, right?
That's correct.
Did the defendant agree to standby counsel here?
Yes, he did. He welcomed standby counsel. He waived his right to counsel initially. Then there was a colloquy, and the court said, you know, do you want an attorney? And then Mr. Campbell said, well, I think that would be a good idea. And then the court entered into the discussion of, well, if you have an attorney and you're at the same time you want to represent yourself, I am going to ask that you pay the fees of standby counsel. And the defendant agreed to do that.
Counsel, as I recall the discussion in your brief, however, you then continued and said, if, however, he had not agreed to reimburse, then the court cannot order it, right?
That's correct. The court can't order him to pay for it. In fact, if the defendant says, the only way I can ask standby counsel is if I pay for it, the courts can't force standby counsel on him or to pay for it. And it's up to the court then to decide whether, in the court's interest, standby counsel still would be necessary to assist the court. The defendant has a choice in all this, whether he wants standby counsel, whether he wants to pay for standby counsel if he has it. And the court.
Why would a defendant want standby counsel as opposed to counsel?
Well, I think this gets into this gray area where you've got a defendant who wants to proceed pro se but then says, well, I'm not sure I can really do this. Let me have somebody help me with this, but really doesn't want to pay for having an attorney.
Well, will the court give him standby counsel if he says, I waive my attorney fees? Judge says, it's a tough case, lots of difficult arguments. We have real doubts whether you can do it. And the guy says, got a little problem, I'm not law trained. And then the judge says, okay, I have the authority to appoint standby counsel. Well, the defendant says, okay, that's your authority, judge, do it. And then the court says, and would you pay for standby counsel? And the defendant says, no. Now, is it the court obligation to appoint standby counsel if the court thinks that it's necessary for the court?
If the court believes it's necessary to assist the court and perhaps to assist the defendant, even though there's
right,
the court can still do it and there's no obligation to pay for it.
But the defendant has no obligation to pay for it.
I mean, the defendant has no
obligation. Okay. I just want to clarify that, Justice Bradley.
It's the same thing. Okay. That is, it's the same thing. If the defendant says, no, I don't want standby counsel, it's your position that the court has no authority under either of these statutes or any place else to order payment of standby
counsel.
That's
correct.
I just want to take you over some already plowed field. I want you to state the state's position on when fraud can be used in a criminal case to challenge a judgment at a civil court.
Sure. Okay. When a defendant wants to challenge, a defendant in a criminal case where one of the elements is that there was a court order that the defendant violated, and the defendant wants to challenge that court order on the ground that the order was procured by fraud, and this is, procured by fraud, the only evidence that would be meaningful and relevant is evidence that goes to that order-issuing court's jurisdiction.
What's the state's public policy argument to narrow that frame in that fashion? I mean, one of the concerns that we as a court has is whether or not we should be encouraging or fostering or allowing fraud to occur in a courtroom setting. And to narrow it to jurisdictional. What's the public policy support for that?
Well, I think it stems from the general proposition that if there's a court order and that court order is not a nullity because the court that issued it had jurisdiction, then any other kind of irregularities that may have occurred in that issuance of that order are not the kind of irregularities that are relevant at all to a violation of that order. In other words, we shouldn't encourage a defendant to say, okay, I think I've got a court order here that's got some problems with it. I can just go ahead and violate it, and I'm not going to be punished for a crime.
Do you want the defendant to go back and challenge it in the original court?
To go back to court. And, of course, in a child custody case, then you've got the other attendant concerns about, well, when it's taking a child, you're taking it from the lawful custodian, the harm, potential harm to the child now being separated. And, of course, the custodian's legal rights to separation, those concerns. There's no reason to do that. You shouldn't be allowed and justified to do that just because you think the court order had some irregularities in it. It's got to be substantial, and the substantial focus is this notion of jurisdiction where the order would be a nullity or void.
Do you mean jurisdiction or do you mean competence, as we use
the term? Well, subject matter jurisdiction and competency. Competency to exercise subject matter jurisdiction is part of what I call subject matter jurisdiction. MCRUD is the case that I come to that talks about when you're talking about certain statutory requirements for the exercise of jurisdiction, that for those statutory requirements, they have to be central, really important. I don't know a better way of describing it, fundamental to that exercise of jurisdiction in order to be the type of fraud has to go to that kind of a thing. Typically, these are like time.
They made a special exception for time. MCRA made a special exception for time
because
it doesn't do that. So you can't put time into the central. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Counsel. Mr. Fetzner, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. I couldn't quite hear what the state had said about the status of this particular custody order regarding the state's competency to act, but I want to be clear that it would be my position that although I would concede that the court under Wisconsin law, the Walworth County Family Court, although the court had subject matter and personal jurisdiction, it would be my position that the court did not have competency to enter the custody order on the ground that Denise was not a natural or adoptive parent of Cody. My position on the law is that it's not necessary for there to be a defect of competency to act, but it would be my position still that under these particular facts, there was a defect on competency, although not a defect on jurisdiction. Again, I think that points to one of the problems with the state's primary theories here of focusing on jurisdiction. The other thing I want to point out, if we're going to talk about policy, I think we shouldn't overlook the trial judges who are going to be affected by this court's ruling on this. If this court's going to enter some kind of ruling where we get away from the existing law of a right to collaterally attack a prior order that was procured by fraud, and we're going to say that there's a limitation to a collateral attack on an order that affected the court's jurisdiction or competency to act, you're making things very difficult for trial judges to be able to ascertain the meaning of those phrases in the context of the particular fraud that's being alleged. This court well knows that it's been struggling with those concepts in the Smith case, in Mickwood case, in all the time limit cases about the meaning of jurisdiction versus competency or whether it's something less or different than all of those. Now, admittedly, these collateral attack based on fraud cases don't come up all that often, But again, I think that you're making it very difficult for trial judges to figure out whether it's a valid defense. It should be remembered in this particular case, the trial judge here felt that he had been somewhat blindsided by the prosecution because his initial ruling barring the evidence was based on the representation of the prosecution that there was an absolute bar on collateral attacks. And it was only when we got to the post-conviction stage that pointed out this line of cases that allows collateral attack based on fraud. And in response to that, what the trial judge did, and I'm not saying it was necessarily inappropriate, but it's at that point that he really shifted the ground of his ruling from the collateral attack to the issue preclusion. And as I explained in my brief, we've kind of been going back and forth on this because when I briefed the case in the Court of Appeals, I primarily focused on issue preclusion because that's what the trial judge ultimately ruled on. And then the state essentially conceded that issue preclusion doesn't apply here. So again, I think it's important that if you're going to talk about a limitation here, that we consider the trial judges.
If we talk about a limitation, and this is throughout this entire case what's bothered me, what is the threshold that the defense that you have to show? Otherwise, what I see, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that why not use this because just throw this out? What is the threshold? And that is what has bothered me in this case, that to allege that you can maintain a collateral attack is fine, but you have to have some basis upon which to use that. What is the threshold in this case? Just that it was procured by fraud because why?
It was procured by fraud because Denise lied essentially in her divorce petition. He can't just throw it out. He has a burden of production of presenting some evidence to support the various aspects of the fraud. He can throw it out. He can throw it out here. He can throw out in virtually every drug delivery case. The defense at some point where there's an undercover agent involved, it's almost invariably thrown out that there was entrapment involved. But that doesn't mean it ever gets as far as an instruction because the defense has the burden of meeting the particular elements that are involved in entrapment. If you don't meet that burden, the judge throws it out.
Well, that troubled me here, and this has been consistent through this case. And you say, well, we don't have to worry about Missouri, but there's been many this and what little we know or I know about the Missouri statutes seem to indicate that here, in this case, both parties petitioned for this. They didn't have to be actually residents when it was completed, and that's all we know. So I, having been a trial judge and having you bring this to me and you say, well, for the sake of trial judges, we should, you know, be interested in this. It would seem to me that there would have to be some more exacting, quote, circumstances for the trial judge to put their arms around, in other words, in just a barefaced allegation. And that's what bothers me in this case.
Well, I agree. If it's actually going to be presented, it has to be more than a bare allegation. I think we have to remember how we got here, that procedurally there was a pretrial ruling by the judge barring the evidence, and at that point the judges said, well, make your offer of proof for purposes of appeal, and that's why we have a rather bare-bones circumstance. The one other thing I wanted to say in response to this, and in general, the courts focus on Missouri. A slight a hypothetical, but very close to this, in terms of all this focus on whether there was a jurisdictional defect in Missouri. Let's assume that there was a defect in Missouri. It could have been cured, or the whole problem could have been eradicated, if Denise, in her divorce petition, said, well, I petitioned for adoption in Missouri, it was granted, but there were some irregularities. I don't think it was really valid. But despite that, I'm asking you to give me custody because my husband is a complete louse, and there's special circumstances here that even if I don't legally qualify as a parent of Cody, I should get the temporary custody anyway. If that had been done, there wouldn't have been any defense of fraud altogether. And again, I think we have to should be focusing on what Denise did in Wisconsin, not what Denise did in Missouri. And there was a valid, for purposes of where the ruling was, Justice Wilcox, he did what he could do given the fact that there was a ruling. Under those circumstances, I believe there was an adequate offer of proof showing a prima facie or some evidence supporting fraud, and accordingly, the judgment of conviction should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vetsmith. Thank you, Mr. Fine, for your arguments today relating to collateral attacks on judgments, and that ends our proceeding on now I have to find my notes on State v. Campbell, case number 2004, AP 0803CR. We'll take a few minutes of recess so these students may leave, and we're going to get students from Lincoln High School and Richard Center High School. We're in recess.